Okay, we're just going to get started. We do have more people than usual. We have our neighbors across the hall, David and Alexis. And
well, let's go around the room so everyone can hear our voices.
Oh, okay.
Welcome to Read Comics, podcast number...
I think this is actually 44.
Wow. 44!
Wow, it's crazy.
Okay, this is Florence.
And Marty.
And Jason.
And Angie.
This is David.
Alexis.
And we also have a couple of babies that will hopefully not be too much a part of the conversation, but we'll see.
Susie on Skype.
Yay!
Yay! Susie's not a baby, though.
Yeah, we want Susie to participate.
All right, so this is a book club podcast, and we're going to talk about Runaways, which was Florence's pick. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yep. So my master plan has actually come to fruition. It looked like for months there that it wasn't. The reason I picked this at Susie's suggestion is that I thought it would be a really good one to include some new people onto the podcast. And I remembered that it was the first comic that I described to Alexis when we first kind of were getting to know each other as neighbors and coming out as geeky comic book people. And I just thought it would be an interesting one to discuss, given her background, she can discuss. A comic that actually tells a story of kids and an allegory of certain kinds of alienation from families and what that means in the Marvel Universe. So what we were going to try to focus on today would be the beginning of that story, even though some of us have read all the way up to through to the recent issues. But we have been given permission to spoil what happens.
Okay, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So...
Well, I'm curious as to Alexis's background you're talking about. So
sounds intriguing.
It does sound intriguing.
She is actually a supergirl. Yeah.
And Ruby, someday we'll find this out.
She was a child supergirl.
Or
they're evil super people.
My background is I'm a child therapist.
Okay.
So, and more specifically a play therapist. So I do play therapy with kids. And I think the conversation came out of a training that I went to in the fall where the presenter was talking about using superheroes in therapy with kids. And so I was kind of asking you some questions, right? Because I knew like you had probably more information about superheroes in comics. And that's when you suggested like that I get to know Runaways. And... So I thought about that, you know, as I was reading it, I was like, yeah, gosh, you know, especially a lot of the teenagers that I've done therapy with and done counseling with and them feeling like their parents don't get them or...
that they're evil?
That, yeah, I don't know if I've ever heard actually a teenager refer to parents as evil, but they certainly, yeah, we're getting close to that. So,
well, then we should probably, for anybody listening who doesn't know the premise of Runaways, we should say... and that is that it is a group of six children. They're all teenagers except for one, Molly, who is the youngest. She's about 11. The rest are between 15 and 17. And they're each the only child in their families. And their families get together every year, so they've known each other all growing up. And at one of these get-togethers where they're all sort of forced to hang out with each other, they decide to spy on their parents and find out what they do every time they get together. And they discover them doing a ritual murder of a young girl. And they kind of freak out about that. And they all decide to run away from home. As they run away from home, they try to gather evidence to take to the police about their parents, and they find out that their parents have, some of them have superpowers, some of them are mutants, some of them are scientists, but they're all decidedly evil. And so the only people who could possibly understand what's going on is each other, so they band together to try to take down their evil parents.
And hilarity ensues.
And they each get either... You know, discover that they have some innate power or become, what's the word? I can't remember the word I'm looking for, but they get a super equipment or stuff. There's a specific word I'm thinking of, and I can't.
More of the Iron Man style of superhero.
Yeah.
Equipped,
mm-hmm. molded on accessories.
Not the word, but that's close. I'll probably sort it out sometime during the podcast.
Perfect.
I remember what it is.
And let's talk a little bit about who created Runaways.
Right, Brian K. Vaughan, who is a big name in comics, and he wrote the first three trades, and so he was the person who created all of these characters from scratch, but it's within the Marvel Universe. So he's within the rules, and there's some peripheral characters that come more into play in later arcs that are already pre-existing Marvel characters, but this is the vision of Brian K. Vaughan, and I think it was successful pretty much right away.
Yeah.
Colleen has lots of opinions.
Yes.
When did Runaways originally come out?
I don't know.
I think maybe 2005, I want to say.
I was going to say, because they made some, temporal references. It seemed relatively modern. I think there was something political. Okay.
And when you, just for novices, when you say successful right away, what does that mean?
It means it's still
they
going.
They were immediately canceled.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, well, I think they got some good reviews right away, and for being a book that was completely new characters, which is difficult to, get anybody to start reading anything that's completely new that doesn't involve already established characters.
Mm-hmm.
That it did, and it managed to sell pretty well for its initial run.
And if I'm correct, I think it also skewed young and female, which was a demographic that, they'd been
mm-hmm.
trying to figure out how to get.
Sure.
And so that was another reason why it was considered successful.
Wow. Okay.
But I don't think it ever sold as well as any of their Spider-Man titles or Avengers or anything like
mm-hmm.
that. It wasn't in that level, but better than it was predicted to be.
I'm curious as to how well it sold compared to Brian K. Vaughan's other hit series.
Well, right, which I'm not remembering off the top of my head. Can you share more about his...
Why the Last Man.
Yes, okay.
But he also did Ex Machina.
The reason I started picking it up was I had already... And Why the Last Man hadn't been going on that long. I think it had only been between 6 months and a year, but I had already, realized I liked that, and then I saw a review of Runaways and realized it was by the same guy and that it sounded very interesting, and so I started picking it up, and then I started sending it to Florence.
This is how I get all of my really awesome stuff. But it's actually, so of those things that Jason just mentioned, I've really liked all of them, especially Why the Last Man, which has finished its run now.
And now he's currently writing Ex Machina, which is another superhero
mm-hmm.
comic.
But superhero with a twist. Political superhero, actually.
Yeah.
He's the mayor of New York and a superhero.
Mm-hmm.
Or he was a superhero, and now he's the mayor of New York.
Yeah.
And he was the superhero first, and everyone knows that it's him,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of the interesting part, I think. Sort of, he's kind of like a Schwarzenegger or something.
Well,
more like
it's
a Sonny
better
Bono,
than that.
Probably.
Sonny
okay,
Bono.
Yeah, actually.
Well, I had a question, since we're kind of talking about existing characters or
mm-hmm.
well-known characters. So, similar to when we read Book of Magic, which is another podcast that was previous, there's a lot of kind of self-referential parts where it's talking about characters that already exist in that universe and storylines clearly that we're kind of supposed to know about, I feel like. Is that a common... Because I haven't read a lot of comics, I'm wondering, is that a common comic book gimmick that you sort of tie in? Or have I just hit a couple that do that? Or
I think when it's a series that's set within a certain universe, then yeah.
Yeah.
If it's completely its own entity, then not necessarily.
Okay.
But yeah, if it's set in like Marvel or DC or any universe, they'll usually... do things like that just to, say, hey, look, we are set in that universe.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
it has kind of a double purpose. One is to, give you a sense of place, sense of the shared universe.
Yeah.
And the other is to kind of, promote
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Other characters, other comics, things like that.
I think
they
should reward people for being collectors of the universe,
sure,
and not just individual titles.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. And now, I mean, there's a big argument over whether this is a good thing, whether this is a bad thing. So many people say, oh, I don't like it because I don't know these characters, and you know what? When I was growing up, I didn't know the characters either, and I just eventually figured out who they were, and I didn't have the internet to look them up at the time.
Back in my day.
Yeah, it's looking like someone clearly on one side of the argument.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of thought a lot about it as I was reading, because it came up against it again, and I was like, okay, so it's probably a thing that happens commonly. And I feel really mixed about it, because sometimes it feels like a commercial to me, and I'm like, really? I'm going to read a commercial when I'm reading a comic book?
The other thing is that all these writers grew up now reading comics.
Sure.
Everyone who writes comics currently spent their whole childhood reading comics. So they have that encyclopedic knowledge.
Right.
So when they toss in these references, it's like nothing to them. It's just part of the script, you know?
Almost like an Easter egg for them. Like,
yeah. Well, and for the other
the
fans
reader,
and
yeah.
stuff, yeah.
And I would assume that they sort of try to choose those tie-ins that if you like this, then you might like this. Like, there's some relevance to how it all ties together, or no?
I think it's more, it depends on the writer, but I get the feeling with like Brian K. Vaughan, it's more of he likes that.
Yeah.
He thought that was cool, so he felt like referencing that, because I do that when I write. Like,
yeah.
I think something's cool, and I think one of my characters would probably think it was cool, I'll just have them reference it. I'm,
It is what it is.
It's
when you go out and find that.
Yeah.
That's every episode of Buffy, right?
Yeah.
There.
Sure. Right. And
people sometimes complained about that too.
True.
There were way too many pop culture references, and that kids didn't really talk like that, and mm-hmm. things like that.
Well, one of the things though that I was thinking is, having read some of the earlier Marvel stuff, especially I've seen the early stuff where there's actually captions, like, in a thing. Like, someone references something that happened last year, and they're like, see, Spider-Man issue number 52, if you want to know what on earth they're talking about.
Annotated.
Yeah.
Like,
that was much more overt, I think, in earlier days.
Yeah, they've kind of stopped that somewhat, especially now that everything is in trade, because they don't want to say, see, issue such and such, when you don't necessarily know what issue you're reading. Because they're all in the trades.
Right.
Well, sometimes, and this is a good example, I mean, you can find what issues are in this trade, but you have to, like, read the, like, 8-point print.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and taking it back to Runaways, I would say, as a relatively naive reader, it did give me a sense of time and place. Like, this is a universe where there are other superheroes. Like, this isn't an anomaly. Like, there's a weird pocket of villains and everyone else is normal, and that there are other things going on. So in some ways, it actually was helpful. So,
and then eventually, they do meet some of the other heroes.
Right.
And
quick aside, I figured out the word.
Yes?
Hey, it's augment.
Augmented, yes.
Okay, thank you. Bothered me for ages and ages.
Well, and of course, one of the references in one of the early issues that tickled me particularly is because it referenced a comic that I read when I was like 12, started when I was 12, and loved because I was the same age as the characters in it. That was Power Pack, which I just recently started reading again. It was a comic about kid superheroes that came out in the 80s from Marvel. And what's the name of the android character in Runaways?
We haven't really gotten to him
that's not him the first.
But his name is Victor. He comes later.
Oh, Victor comes later. Because I think he's the one who actually... Because he's kind of a superhero junkie.
Mm.
I think he's the one who says, what are you guys, Power Pack? Or something like that. And I just recently started rereading those comics. You know, there's a whole, like, subgenre of comic series where it's the teen and kid superheroes that I think are it really is almost a separate genre of superhero comics.
Well, it is and it isn't. It's Because, I mean, some of the most popular mainstream superheroes started when they were teenagers, like Spider-Man. And
it's true.
Other people that I can't think of right now. Maybe the X-Men, were they teenagers?
Well, technically, yes.
Yeah.
The X-Men were teenagers when they started. The
teenagers.
Original five were teenagers. The new X-Men, I don't know if they were, like Storm and Nightcrawler and all of them.
Well, but X-Men has always featured, well, anyway, for as long as I've ever featured the school.
It's
know,
true.
With,
yeah.
I mean, there are kids in it.
But, I mean, they really feature those in the New Mutants comic,
mm-hmm.
where they
right.
did get a new generation of kid superheroes, and those were the New Mutants. And then the analog in the DC was the new Teen Titans, which was all of the sidekicks of the heroes in their own comic.
And you know, like one of the reasons I think that that is such a big subgenre is just that because that age is so, you know, innately dramatic in itself, that it's really good to see that time period.
Well, we don't really see as many, I mean, before Runaways, I think the last one we really saw for that was New Warriors, and they just haven't, we haven't been seeing the teen and kid comics as much lately.
DC is still doing Teen Titans, or just Titans, and Young Justice, and whatever else they have.
No, that's true, that's true. And now they brought back, the original Teen Titans. I'm just calling it Titans because they're not teenagers anymore. Anyway, so Runaways.
Yes.
Yeah. I noticed that bringing back the references like to pop culture and stuff, I remember this was weird when I read it, and I was just kind of paging through, and there's like a whole page where they're talking about the Prisoner DVDs. I'm like, really? Why? I don't know.
Well, and I could see maybe two of the characters being interested in the Prisoner DVDs. Which characters are talking about it?
It's Alex and Nico.
Yeah.
I don't remember them like going into a group discussion about it. All I remember is that Alex is kind of annoyed that Nico he lent them to her and she hasn't given them back yet. And
well,
then
she says,
"Oh, here are those DVDs."
And she says, "They were amazing." And he says, "They were." And she says, "Completely. The Chimes of Big Ben was intense. I can't believe how old that show is, you know? It feels like it's from the future."
Okay. So maybe there was more discussion than I remember.
That was it, but it felt like that was an ad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a full page.
Yeah.
And the cover of the DVD set is twice
really? Oh,
on the page.
I didn't notice that at all. Again, it's one of those things where I just figured Brian K. Vaughan's set and thought it was cool. I just thought it would be cool to have them talk about it.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know anything about The Prisoner. Like, is it relevant at all to the story, do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I've never seen it. So
I have.
It was a commercial. It didn't work very
well. I have seen it a long time ago in high school. Because some boy wanted to see it. And I was so bored, I remember I kissed him. Just to do something else.
This is
probably not quite the strategy I had in mind, but I guess it all worked out.
That's kind of like my memory of like watching a friend of mine wanted to see Seven Samurai, and I was so bored I started doing homework, which I never did homework ever.
I could maybe see it being somewhat relevant in that it's about a person who's kind of trapped in a situation over which they have no control.
Oh.
Which is kind of being a teenager and
right. thematic anyway.
Thinking everyone's against you and maybe. Oh, maybe Brian K. Vaughan's just a big Prisoner fan.
Right.
Which is probably more likely.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Prisoner to know how relevant it is to the story.
Wait, Susie?
Yeah.
Do you have a rating on the background noise level?
I'm fine with it.
Yep.
It doesn't bother me. It's not like it's really intense.
Okay.
I just find it a little amusing.
Ruby's giving us a show.
Yeah, Ruby is David and Alexis's
so
daughter.
Let's hear from David and Alexis about what they. I mean, we've been going on and on. So let's hear what you guys think about what you've read so far.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I did want to make one comment about the pop culture references. There was one page, there was actually two pages where they made like six different references, and I thought it was one of the funniest pages because it was when they were driving. I can't find it now, but I just thought that, you know, I guess I just hadn't seen that, and I thought it was actually kind of humorous, and I was going to try to remember which page they did like. That they make these several references, but I can't find it right away.
Do you remember what they were referencing?
If I find it, one was a food shop, one was another program. If I look through here, I'll find it. It may have been when they were setting out to when they initially got into the van to set out. Oh, here it is. This might be it. This might be the page. I ran away from home and now I'm running back there. This is purely smash and grab, girl. We'll be in and out. Please don't say in and out. I'd kill for one of their burgers right now. About now, because having witnessed the murder, you know. And then they go on to talking. Not Chase, talks about the man dropping the man off the radar. I mean, I just thought some of the references were actually quite relevant or good. But I think for me, the story, I actually had thought the story was something else before I read it, and it sets up really nicely for the first booklet. I'm anticipating what's going to come next. So I feel like I got engaged with the characters. They were well explained. There's a guy who's kind of a little bit off. That'll be Chase. There's sort of the strategy guy. That's Alex. And then, you know, the female characters all have very clearly different roles. I thought the Velociraptor was a little strange when it first came in.
She grows on you, though. She really does. Like, I'm like, I kind of want one now.
I thought Chase would have been injured when that Velociraptor jumped on him with the claws, but he was okay. He came out okay.
For how intentionally dangerous Velociraptors are.
Yeah. Well, how do you know?
Damage.
Maybe they were really cuddly.
All we know is what Michael Crichton sold us.
That's right.
Right, and Chase is not one of the kids who inherited any kind of superpowers.
Right.
So he
did get some weapons, though.
Yes.
Right, okay. He's augmented.
He's
kids,
augmented.
So he got their evil weaponry.
And that was also interesting to have. In my mind, it's always like one or the other. They're either a superhero that it's all like equipment-based, like technology, you know, they just have a cool setup, or they're mutants, or they have special powers, or whatever it is, but to have a mix of them together and kind of see how that works out. And then in some, like, book 2 and 3, among the adults, there's kind of this subplot going on where they are kind of two cliques, and they're kind of plotting against each other, because they don't really like each other, but...
Well, they're villains.
Yeah.
Right.
The villains never...
Right.
That is always their downfall.
Can't trust another villain,
right? That is why, what's it? Comic Wanted would not ever really work. Is I mean,
there's no such thing as organized crime.
Yeah.
And
so their parents are collectively known as the Pride, and they're sort of a superpowered mafia.
Mm-hmm.
But
did
only on the West Coast.
Did you guys see the movie Wanted?
Yes.
It's loosely based on the comic, but the comic has a really interesting
premise. Right, exactly. It skips
premise.
The coolest part.
Yeah, the coolest the coolest part of the comic is its premise, I think. And the premise is that there's this supervillain syndicate that essentially runs the world. They won.
Right.
There was the
superhero versus supervillain, and supervillains won, and this is the new world order.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's just like the backdrop of it, and then there's a story from there.
And so
the
they kind of took the story, extracted it from that premise, and then that's the movie.
In the movie, it's not superheroes; they're just assassins.
So
okay.
The one with Angelina Jolie.
Yeah. Sorry, Susie.
Yeah, what did you say?
And they also added a magic weaving machine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh man. Yeah, they extracted the cool premise and created just a really dumb one. about magic.
That's for Quake.
Yes.
So, but it is kind of relevant to this, I think, in that, you know, it's like there's this super villain team up.
And they control Los Angeles in the Marvel Universe. They have moles and all in the police, and that's why the kids can't just simply go to the police, because the police are on the payroll of the Pride.
Mm-hmm. And they try to.
They report that, they try to go to the police. And the police, to begin with, like, the person taking the call who isn't a mole just is like, oh yeah, your parents are evil. You know, okay, thanks for calling. Hangs up, and then but he still sort of reports it to the person, and like, the word gets back to the person who is the mole in the police department, and they tell the Pride, and that's how the Pride find out the kids know.
In the realm of this series, the Pride controls the West Coast. Well, specifically L.A.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really talk too much about
Portland,
the
Oregon.
Entire
yeah.
West Coast.
Yeah.
But it refers to why there's never...
reach throughout the rest of the West Coast, but their main power center is L.A.
It talks about why no supervillains really ever operate in L.A. And because the Pride is in control, they're in charge, they take care of everything. But this is where the whole timeline of the Marvel Universe gets kind of weird, where it's like every so often you get these things where beginning of the Marvel Universe, it's this sliding timeline where everything happened within like the last 5 to 10 years, even though, you know, it's been going on since the 60s, everything happened within the last 5 to 10 years. So
that's why Peter Parker, who's been, you know, active since the 60s, is only, you know, and a superhero since he was, 16, is only like 28?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe 30. So the West Coast Avengers, they're in the 80s, there was a branch of the Avengers that operated out of L.A.
Oh.
for, you know, over a decade in the 80s and 90s. And with the whole sliding timeline, that would have had to have overlapped somewhat, I think.
Yeah.
Well, does the Pride... I mean, the Pride doesn't exist in any other series. Like,
no, well, they're new.
Right.
I mean, they were introduced for Runaways, and Runaways started well after the West Coast Avengers was canceled.
But they've only been in this universe. They formed not because they just decided to, but because these beings intervened, saw potential in all of them.
They were summoned.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Basically told that you are now in control of Los Angeles, but you serve us.
But how long has that been going on?
Right.
Well, all the kids are... The oldest kid is 17. And they were active for maybe a few years before the kids were born. So 20 years at the most?
20
yeah.
years. So with the whole side timeline, there would have had to have been some overlap.
Yeah.
But,
right.
yeah, it's just one of those things where you don't think about it too hard.
They laid low a little bit more while those Avengers were around.
Right. Well, and... I mean, one of the things that, you know, one of the reasons it's set in the West Coast, I think, is just the Marvel Universe is really saturated on the East Coast.
It's true.
So
well,
they do visit
New
York. Right.
Yeah.
They do visit New York later, and it's very clear that there's, you know, a zillion superheroes and supervillains
in
New York.
So once they discover this and realize the police can't be trusted, politics can't be trusted, newspapers can't be trusted, they've all been bulls, they try to contact the Avengers. Because they figure, okay, well, you know, supervillains, who's going to deal with that? Let's get the superheroes, but of course, the Avengers just are not readily contactable.
Well, initially, they're approached by Cloak and Dagger. Cloak and Dagger are directed to find them, tricked into thinking that they're actually murderous young teenagers on a rampage.
I forgot about that. Their parents, once they realize the kids know who they really are and are trying to fight them, use their contacts in the police and the press to make it to frame them from the girl that they saw their parents murder. And basically, so now they're wanted.
It's interesting that Cloak and Dagger were featured so early on in this series, because to bring up Power Pack again, Cloak and Dagger were also featured very prominently in that series, which, I mean, those heroes were younger, where Alex, the oldest, was maybe 14, and Katie, the youngest, would have been 6 or 7. And they were, you know, like, Cloak and Dagger were the older superheroes that they looked up to who were still teenagers at the time. And I think they're supposed to still be kind of teenagers in this, maybe early 20s.
Supposed to be younger than the Avengers, at least.
Yeah.
And it helps that they were teenagers when they became superheroes, because once, you know, obviously they have the meeting between the two and the misunderstanding, and they fight, they even reference that.
Yeah.
And that scene of, like, hello, two super groups that don't understand each other, and maybe they fight. That they're able to make them understand the truth, because they don't necessarily trust adults and stuff.
Well, Alexis, you didn't really, we didn't get your opinion.
Yeah,
what did you think?
Well, you know, as somebody new to this whole world, I thought really entertaining. I got a little hung up on a minor detail, which was I was really confused by Molly.
Mm.
And I was just saying to David, I was like, I said to him, okay, how old is she supposed to be?
Yeah.
And, because obviously she comes across as younger, but... he said she's 11, and I said, is she developmentally delayed?
Right.
Did you feel like that too?
She's, like, yeah, she's very infantile. I mean, to a point that it becomes unbelievable. Like, if they're making such a point that she's developmentally...
In such a different place.
Right. That she's, yeah, like, yeah.
That's a good point. Our
is
nephew
is 10,
and
11?
He acts like he can be a teenager.
Well, she's just not sophisticated at all. I mean, she's not only
are
they always continually sheltering her from everything.
Because you're halfway, you're sort of, you feel, I know, I remember, like, being 10 and thinking, wow, I'm not a kid anymore. I'm totally an adult. But then, you know, reacting to things exactly the way a kid would, you know.
Yeah, but she...
I didn't get my way, you know, not wanting to deal with anything, actually...
Well, of course,
responsibility in any way.
Alexis, you're coming at this from a background where you're dealing with so many kids, and you would be able to pick up on that. Where, I mean,
yeah.
I don't think I necessarily picked up on it, but I don't have many 11-year-olds in my life.
Well,
so.
I think that it is something that's actually mentioned later, if I can spoil it, in, like, the next 18 issues or so, somebody calls her on it, of like, hey, and at this point she's 12. Like, you're 12. Why are you still acting like you're 7? And she kind of, like, admits that she's been using the fact that she's younger than everybody to her advantage.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
As a defense mechanism. But also, I don't think it's necessarily a completely mask, but I think she does play it up.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like, you know, if you're 11 years old, okay, so, you know, they're, they've gone through these catacombs, and then they know their parents are going to suspect something, so they all kind of go racing back to the room they're supposed to be in this kind of arcade room, and, you know, and they're discussing, like, oh my god, like, I can't believe we saw our parents doing that, and she says, I know what you guys are whispering about, duh, S-E-X, and I'm thinking to myself, what? Like, it's a five-year-old's response, you know? I mean, it was so bizarre. And then so I started reading the rest of it through the lens of, like, oh, there's something, like, she has special needs. Fascinating.
Yeah, I think you definitely...
I mean, 11 years old, plus they make this reference to her, like, maybe starting her period. Is that what this whole thing about, like, oh, Gert said I got the curse. I didn't believe her, but then a little bit of blood came out of my... And then the mom interrupts her. And
yeah.
I'm like, huh.
Yeah.
So this 11-year-old, like, has no concept of like what getting her first period might be.
Right.
Or, like,
her parents may not have, you know, prepared her very well, being busy with super villainy.
Right. Right. That's
probably not mom of the year. So.
That's one of the detriments of having a parent that
and I think that actually was a reference to her it's a misdirect that she might be getting her period. I think it's actually a reference to the fact that she's getting her mutant powers.
It's getting her superpowers, yeah, right.
Because in the Marvel universe, if you're a mutant, it doesn't come on until as you start adolescence. You're not automatic, usually you're not born with powers. They sort of develop.
So it is really important that she's at that age, actually, for the mutant storyline.
Yep.
But I think we've hit upon an area of expertise that Alexis has that maybe Brian K. Vaughan doesn't have, which is child development.
Well, and I kind of wonder if that, if what you're talking about, Susie, where he brings up an explanation, I wonder if he had gotten a lot of feedback from people reading it going, what's going on?
Yeah.
And so he's like, oh, I guess I have to write something in now to explain this.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
like I said, I think that it's totally plausible for an 11-year-old to act totally childish. I don't think it's necessarily that they're not capable of being more mature, but I still think they are also capable of being really childish because they're in that in-between stage.
What grade is 11 years old?
Fifth or sixth, yeah.
Yeah,
she could be more sophisticated if she chose to.
And I mean, I get, like, because, you know, the other piece of it is not only is she kind of slightly immature, but they treat her like that,
yes.
You know? So they're like,
that's
get Molly out of
right.
here,
yeah.
And that I got. Like, I can imagine a bunch of 17-year-olds looking at 11-year-old and being like, okay, you're not going to be able to deal with this, so, you know, kind of, you're going to be removed from the situation. But an 11-year-old responding and being like, no, wait a minute, like, I'm picking up on more stuff than you think I am, you know?
Right.
And there's something wrong in this
right.
picture, and at least picking up on emotional cues,
right.
if not kind of being able to fully interpret what's actually happening. So.
Well, I think her role in the group is important in the sense that it is someone, like, that is at a different stage, and that they're trying to protect her. Like, they, you know, part of them growing up is protecting Molly.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in addition to the murder at the beginning, the very fact that the parents would use her as a pawn and threaten to kill her shows the, I'm going to use the standard of deviation, the deviance, standard of deviance is what I want to say, of this group of criminals.
Another thing that kind of piques my curiosity, and it probably gets explored later on, is that there's a reference in one of the scenes where they've got Molly and they're, you know, on the phone making the threat and, like, setting up the whole trap. And then when they come in that first time to rescue Molly, one of the mutants says to the girl with, is it Gertrude? The one with the dinosaur?
Mm-hmm.
She says, like, you're the expendable one. Like, all their other kids are special, but, like, we've all already decided that you'd be the first one to take out.
Right.
That's interesting, because she's not the only one who doesn't have superpowers. So, what's going on with the other kids that supposedly are, quote-unquote, normal, right, that apparently aren't, and I strongly probably suspect that there is probably something special about Gertrude. We just don't know what it is yet. So.
Well, I think the thing that, like, they decided that Gert is expendable is because she is the least trusting of them. She doesn't have any powers other than the fact that she's psychically linked to this dinosaur.
Right.
But she's also, you know, the mouthiest one. She's the one who has the least amount of respect for them. Even the others who are, you know, aware of it that they're evil.
Right.
So she's still a little cowed by them. But she even before she knew they were evil, she thought they were pretty evil.
Right. So she can't be manipulated as easily as the rest. So
yeah.
She would be the one to take out first.
She, by the way, is like one of my favorite characters ever.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well,
I you know, she's a teenage character in a book. And we haven't said anything about the art, but the art is fabulous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the things I do really love about this particular artist, his name is Adrian Alfano, is that he draws them and they look like teenagers. They don't look like
7-year-olds. Yep, they look like real kids.
In teenage fashion.
Yep.
Which is a backhanded statement about the later artists, which I like much less than this arc.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But, yeah, he really does do a great job. And Gert, in particular, because, you know, Carolina, she's undoubtedly hot. And Nico is small and aging and tiny and skinny. But Gert is not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's still fantastic. She's an awesome character,
yep.
You know. There's nothing detrimental to her in that she's not your typical girl.
Well, I think it also speaks to the power dynamic amongst the parents.
Right.
That, you know, some of the parents have more. So, actually, let's go through what each of the kids and the parent pairing are and what their powers are. And I'm also curious about who, you know, what the favorites are for everybody.
Mm. And we should also, at this point, bring up, because I think it ties up, one thing that gets brought up in the pretty early on, actually, is that there's a mole within the group.
Mm-hmm.
The parents start getting messages, anonymous messages, from within the group of kids that they're still on the side of the parents and that they are going to do whatever they can to undermine the rest of the kids and actually take them down.
Right, and I feel like that's the one thing that I can't bear to spoil for Alexis and David.
I'm not going to.
Yeah.
It goes as we're going to be discussing each one. So, should we introduce each kid?
Yeah.
When we first meet Alex, he's the first kid that we're introduced to in the first book.
Like on the first page.
On the first page.
And I forget, does his parents have powers?
I think they are the only ones that don't have powers.
They're just like organized crime, gangster, like power couple.
Mm.
That's what I kind of took away
from it. Kind of the Kingpin cross with Dr. Doom.
Yeah.
What's Susie?
I was just going to say, they seem very smart, very capable of power brokering kind of people. And then Alex, he doesn't have any powers either, but it's established very early on that he is really smart. He's kind of got strategist,
mm-hmm.
as it were. He's also a fanboy in his own way. He loves superheroes.
Okay, we've talked a little bit about Gert. I don't remember what her parents are like, though. Are they the time travelers?
They're the time travelers.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's how they end up with the dinosaur. Although the dinosaur isn't from the dinosaur age, it's from future.
Right, genetically engineered.
Dinosaur
right.
And do they establish why she has the psychic link?
That's part of the genetic modification.
Yeah, they all do in the future. Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
Sorry,
yeah.
The dinosaur is a female. Her name's Old Lace, and she was from a time period in the future where they can genetically engineer pets, and so they engineered her to be psychically linked to this family.
And then there's Nico.
A goth girl.
Goth girl, and her parents are magic users.
Dark magic users.
Magic users, and...
she inherits the staff of one.
Yep.
Which I think it'll be such an interesting story arc when we get to it. I mean, do they tell that story down the line of like the staff? Yeah.
What the staff does and how? Not really.
No,
we pretty much know what she knows about. She figures out how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that's a good point about almost everything. For the kids, like we don't really get backstories of their parents and the origins of all their stuff.
Okay,
we just get the kids trying to figure it out and use it now.
Okay,
but it does have some drawbacks in that she can never use the same spell twice.
What did you?
No, I remember when I read that first. I remember thinking, like, this has got to be a gimmick from another comic. Like,
yeah.
I felt like it was a reference to something. But Jason, do you think that it is?
It's not ringing any bells.
Yeah.
She can't ever use the same spell twice, so she's gotta think a lot more about her feet while she does this. So if she wants to get a result, she has to come up with something new every time.
And it backfires on occasion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of makes me think of Presto's hat in the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon.
Oh.
Where it worked, but sometimes not the way he would expect
it
to.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's also magically absorbed into her body.
Right. That's what I wanted to talk to.
Yeah.
I want to see what Alexis thought about. So the concept is that in order to summon the staff, she has to cut herself.
And coincidentally, she's also the God Girl.
Right. And so it was interesting. I read that and I kind of thought about, well, this is, this feels like it is for, like Florence was saying, teens, you know, or maybe even tweens, and probably geared towards girls. And here we're cutting.
Mm.
Like, it was kind of interesting. And even
right.
one of the characters that comes into the story, the vampire boy, actually talks about, well, my ex-girlfriend gave me this pamphlet about cutting and why she couldn't express her anger properly. It just seemed kind of odd to me. that it was just kind of thrown in there, like a
right.
pop culture reference to cutting.
Right,
I don't know.
Right.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
That is interesting. I never thought about that
yeah.
before.
I didn't pick up on that.
I remember thinking it was weird at the time, actually.
Yeah.
I thought it was a strange...
Yeah, I got used to it, but at the time, I totally was like, really? Okay.
And the message is not that it's bad. Like, it's not like they're like, don't cut kids, it's a bad idea. Like,
well,
like, it's just how it is.
I guess I could say that... I would say that... I don't feel like they glorify it. I mean, she does, you know... there is obviously a metaphor in there for
right.
that it gives her power, but it, you know, they don't. It still causes her pain. She
True.
Does express
well,
the pain.
Finds it inconvenient and embarrassing as well.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so I don't think it glorifies
secret.
It.
Yeah,
but you know,
would be something that cutters would feel too.
Right.
At least the embarrassment.
Right.
And
you probably don't want people to know about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting, it's a very interesting element to add to that. So, okay, so we covered Alex and Miko, Molly, and Gert. Then there's Chase.
Did we cover Molly?
Oh, we talked about her. But she's a mutant, and her parents are mutants.
And her power is super strength, but in very short bursts, which then...
Like, tire her out?
Yeah.
Which is something I totally forgot about, because I think they kind of dropped that as the series went on.
Well, I mean, it's a...
She just developed to the point where she no longer...
It's a plot point that's used when it's convenient to use.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then ignored when it's convenient to be ignored.
And her parents, as mutants, they are the Magneto type, and that they feel like they are the superior race.
Yeah, it's funny too, because I remember thinking at the time that, like, the fact that she fell asleep further illustrated how young she was. It was sort of like a little, you know, a kid, like, tiring themselves
out.
Yeah, exactly.
You had a big day.
She really did seem more like she was 3 or 4.
Yeah,
than she's very hyper.
11.
But you can't really call her innocent.
Well, not anymore.
Yeah.
She had been up until that point.
But she's incredibly hyper. She's not completely naive.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking back to when I was doing children's theater and the girls who would have been around fifth, sixth grade, and how they, that was really the stage where I was wanting to, you know, drop them off of a cliff.
And, you know, it may just be an indication of the fact that this is being written by a male.
Yeah.
I think 11-year-old boys are this hyper and this immature. Maybe not necessarily 11-year-old girls all the time.
Yeah.
That was kind of the point where the girls were starting to develop little cliques where they would, you know, all find one girl who they would gang up on. And...
Oh, God. It's 12 to 13-year-olds. I kind of have this theory that 13, like, if you are the person, the worst you're ever going to be is when you're 13.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're a bad person, you know, that's where it kind of starts and just keeps going. But, yeah.
So then, then there's Carolina.
Which I say Carolina in my head.
Carolina for me.
Yeah, me too.
They don't make it clear.
Okay.
Maybe it's because my sister's name is Lena, spelled L-I-N-A.
Oh.
So.
The daughter of actors in Hollywood. She's like a Hollywood kid.
Yeah,
yep.
Tall, willowy, blonde. Yeah,
crunchy granola. They eat tofu and.
Do they have superpowers? I can't even remember.
Well, yes.
Yes.
Have they gotten?
Turns out that they are aliens.
I was gonna say, have they gotten to that point?
Right.
Yeah,
I forgot about that actually.
And she can be all glowy and sparkly, and it turns out this has been kept from her whole life. There's been a device she's worn that's like shielded her powers from herself and from others.
It's a medic alert bracelet that she was told she has to wear because she's deathly allergic to something or something like that. And it turns out she's never taken it off, and then one time she does, she realizes that...
Like, she starts to glow,
right.
And float, and, she's this amazing, beautiful, angelic alien thing.
And I thought it was interesting that they're quite beautiful, like you're saying, glowy, angelic, like, technicolor, but the costumes or disguises that the adults wear look like gross aliens.
Yeah.
right.
I was like,
right?
They look like bug eyes. Like they're not attractive. It's really kind of funny. Apparently, you want to be an ugly alien.
Their heads,
yeah.
Like brings through their nose and stuff.
Yeah.
I always took it as bondage.
Yeah.
Okay, so that leaves Chase.
Chase, yes. And
he's the oldest of all of them.
Mm-hmm. Was he the oldest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's 17, I think. And the rest are... Yeah, I think so. He is 17. Alex, Carolina, Nico, they're all around 16. Gerd is 15. And Molly's 11.
And I actually think Chase is one of the most interesting characters in it, in my opinion.
No, he really, he's become one of my favorites. I do not think that was my opinion at the beginning.
No, not at all.
So Chase is the son of genius scientists, and he himself has not inherited those attributes.
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it kind of comes out later that he's a lot... that he's a lot smarter. He just never really applied himself.
Well, and there's also the issue that his parents are based his father, and his father doesn't seem to be doing anything about it, but his father's pretty abusive.
Yeah.
So that could be part of his rebellion of, I don't need to be smart. You assholes are smart. You know, what has it gotten you?
And he's like the total guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Part,
he's the jockey.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
He's kind of the... Ashton Kutcher character.
That's a good comparison, yeah.
Yeah,
it's
really
good. That's how he comes across.
Yeah. Kind of a slacker.
He's kind of an airhead.
Yeah, he doesn't want to do a lot of work.
He's interested in getting girls in and, playing video games and skateboarding.
And he doesn't really have the principled response that some of the other kids have to their whole situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's unclear. One of the things I was just looking at, he ends up getting a power. He kind of plays around with his parents' toys, and then all of a sudden he's stuck with them. So I'm unsure whether he doesn't ever take them off. So I'm not sure if they're melded onto him or I don't know. I mean,
it becomes clear that basically just he hasn't figured out how to take them off.
Okay.
He can't take them off.
Okay.
Just he figured out how to get them on and how to use them, but. At that point, he either can't figure out how to get him off, or he just isn't interested in figuring out how to get him off.
Eventually.
They're like gloves that she creates.
Yeah.
You would think you wouldn't want to shower with those on.
Right.
Well, actually, it, all of a sudden it occurs to me that being a 17-year-old boy, he probably would want to actually get them off. At
flaming
some
gloves.
Point.
Yeah.
So they're called the Fistigons, and they're these. They're not
Which is another great.
Skeletons on his hands that shoot fire and electrical bolts and other good stuff.
And so I have just a quick comment, and that was, just going back to a comment somebody else made, and I was thinking about this, and I'm thinking about a little bit for the last maybe 10 minutes. And that was somebody talked about like how some of these powers come out when they become adolescents.
Mm.
And I was just thinking about, for a lot of, going back to like my child therapy perspective, how, you know, for a lot of people, they're predisposed to mental illness. Mm. Like, that comes out in puberty.
Yeah.
You know, for some, not for all, obviously.
Yeah,
adulted,
and, yeah.
So I was just kind of thinking about that, you know, like the kind of allegory of your, you know, whatever it is that's in you, and or like that you might be
mutant.
Yeah, predisposed to, and then you become an adolescent, and then that thing kind of like takes flight.
Well, the whole mutant thing in the Marvel Universe has been an allegory for the other since the very beginning.
Is it? Yeah.
Whether
yeah.
the other is mental illness or homosexuality
right.
or just about anything that is the other.
Right.
You know, the X-Men, when it started, they were a group of mutants and the world hated and feared them, but they did their best to help the world secretly.
Which is also, like, right in the early 60s, which is also in the heart of the civil rights movement, too. So here they are, this completely other race that people discriminate against.
And it's always been kind of strange where mutants, I mean, it's been very mystifying to me in the Marvel Universe how they deal with the whole mutant thing, because most heroes, however they get their powers, are lauded. The Fantastic Four, the Avengers, all these, you know, they get their powers because they're bathed with cosmic rays, and now they're superheroes. But just because someone was born with them, they're hated, and that's always kind of been a real stretch for me. And they've worked with it on occasion, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, the Fantastic Four doesn't wear masks.
And the other exception to that being Spider-Man, who is, for the most part, not, you know, some people consider him a hero, other people think he's a criminal, and he's never...
And a lot of that...
...the same kind of acclaim that the Fantastic Four have.
That's
well, he
true.
Has a media mogul, like, trying to actively
yeah.
make people think that, though.
That's been a lot of, yeah, press-related, I think, you know.
But I think it is, it kind of goes back to them being teenagers, and it's just one of those, and then I think that's one of the, like, one of the reasons Buffy.
One of the what?
This as well, is that feeling of being just being a teenager, where you know you're different. Every teenager thinks they're different.
Right.
And a freak, and, you know, unpopular, whatever. And they also sort of think, oh, it's kind of special, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's just everybody just, you know, realized how cool I was, but oh god, I'm not, you know, that kind of thing. And
well,
it's just sort of was an allegory for that as well.
Right. I mean, isn't it one of the divides between DC heroes and Marvel heroes that DC heroes are more universally loved, and Marvel heroes tend to have a more complex relationship with the public, and, you know, have more angst around their powers and what that means for them in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Can we go back to Carolina for a minute? Because
yeah.
I don't think we talked about, there's some allusions to her having a crush on
yes.
Nico. And that was another thing that really, I thought was really cool. Especially thinking about sort of that tween age, there could be some girls who are starting to have crushes on, you know, their little girlfriends around them, and to have that kind of mirrored back to them in a kind of normalizing way, you know, in a way that would, you know, that they would maybe see. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah. So
there's a lot of that going on in that, you know, it's very clear immediately that Chase is into Carolina, just because Carolina's very, very hot. And
well, they're kind of the prom king and queen.
Yeah. It's like, ooh, hot girl.
Yeah.
And then that Alex is interested in Nico, and she might be interested in Alex. And then there you get references that Carolina has a crush on somebody in the group. And then they're very subtle. Like, I think pretty much everybody did pick up on that it was Nico.
Well, to some people.
All right, so you all said that you don't care about spoilers, right?
Me?
Well let me
except
just say,
for who the mole is. I think
no.
we should let
no,
that.
That's fine.
But everything else I'm okay with.
Okay, Carolina is a lesbian.
Right,
okay.
She fully comes
oh, yeah.
out, and it's
really?
Like,
yes.
Yeah,
oh, that's fantastic.
Had relationships there, and there's,
right.
a, yeah, there's, like, that's just an established part of her character. And it's these early days that people are, you know, it's against type that she's the pretty blonde prom queen.
Right.
But it just
makes it
integrated into her character.
And they've actually they've had crossovers with Runaways with another group of young superheroes called the Young Avengers, which has a young gay male couple, Wiccan and Hulkling.
One of whom is also an alien.
Yep, and there's actually been some controversy about these crossovers that have been written by other writers, where for whatever reason, the in
Super
both of these crossovers, the party gets split.
Oh yeah,
The characters that end up being trapped and tortured just coincidentally happen to be all the gay characters.
Oh.
And,
it was kind of...
And the writer says, oh, yeah, I guess I didn't realize I was doing that. And everyone else is like, well, we all did.
Yeah, he purposely got all the gay characters together. Because there was constantly, you guys are aliens and gay, so are we. You guys had the supervillain, so did we. You know, there's that. He wanted to play out the similarities and the differences between them. But yeah, he did that by getting them all together, captured and tortured.
So as these are adolescents, has there been any political fallout or ramifications for having...
I don't know.
Anybody's heard about? Have you heard anything in the Marvel Universe about flack for this?
To be honest, I think comics are so much under the radar these days
of the general populace
that, I mean, there are always the right-wing blowhards who will look for anything in pop culture but middle America, the general populace, comics have kind of fallen so much off the radar that it doesn't. People are like, oh, yeah, gays in comics, big deal.
Well, and it also helps that these are relatively, they're like you said, they've got a following in the comics community, but nobody knows who the Runaways are who doesn't read comics.
Yeah.
If, say, Captain America and Spider-Man hooked up,
I was just thinking about, like, you know, Sesame Street, they tried to introduce an HIV positive character, and it was like, you know,
and it wasn't even World War III. It was Sesame Street itself, it was the South African
version
of Sesame Street, because they have all these different Sesame Street programs around the world that are tailored to the community that they're meant for, and it's because, and they specifically did that because the community that this was going out to, like, had this incredibly high percentage of people who are living with HIV.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it was one of those things, this is a part of these children's lives.
Right,
right.
Totally appropriate.
And they all see it, and it's Takalani Sesame, and this character talks about her mom who's already passed away, and it's a really positive thing there. Like, most kids manage to see it, but so that's why I thought Carolina would be such a great someone to kind of read
and
identify
with.
The
other problem is that, I mean, why is it, you have the right-wing conservatives who say, oh, look at what the kids are reading. But the thing is that I think so many people realize that, no, the kids are not reading these comics anymore.
There was an uproar to some extent when it was revealed that, it wasn't even revealed within the books. The author just said this. Oh, I always thought Dumbledore was gay.
Right.
Right. And it was like, it was like chumming
that,
the water.
Huge amount of kids read. Far more than Runaways. Far more than Spider-Man.
Comics in general.
So then there was, oh my God, gay agenda hidden in Harry Potter.
I mean, what comics are teenagers reading? They're really not reading the Marvel and DC comics. They're reading Naruto. They're reading
the Japanese.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep.
So,
although it is interesting to note that there is the Runaways was reissued in the manga sized format.
Yeah. Which is a marketing ploy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Marvel going, oh, maybe if we do this, kids will get tricked into thinking it's,
well, yeah,
you know.
It's more likely that they'll end up in the bookstores on the bookshelves that the kids are looking at.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I read
at a price that's a lot more reasonable than like the $20 trades.
Yep.
Yeah, well, Angela was just saying the one she got from the library was the mega sized.
Was the mega? I guess mega sized. I would just say it was teeny. and I did enjoy the trade more because I definitely got to see the artwork on a scale that was more easily appreciated.
Which is what it was. What it was originally conceived as that size.
Well, before we leave the relationship point, I'm glad you brought that up, Angela, because I was going to ask about that. So my question was going to be, you know, here, clearly Nico was into Alex, and Carolina was into Nico, and Chase was into Carolina. And then, of course, Alex is the one who aggressively goes after, Nico goes after Alex. Is this the norm in terms of this kind of a publication that these relationships are so early, first of all, they're established early, but secondly, you know, the traditional superheroes have a lot of angst around relationships. Peter Parker, Clark Kent. I mean, there's just difficulty. Batman's a bachelor.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, there's none of that. What's sort of the norm now in some of these, even in Young Avengers or some of these other...
I kind of think it depends on if it's a team book or if it's a single book. Because, yeah, with team books, it tends to be relationships within the team.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it's a single character, then they have, not necessarily, they usually don't have a super-powered love interest. They have a civilian love interest, and then it's all, you know, oh, I've got to protect them, they'll be in danger.
Mary Jane's in danger again.
You know,
that's right.
What happens if they find out who I really am? Whereas this, you know, they all know who each other are. They're in each other's faces all the time, every day, and in danger no matter what.
And I think that... I think they are trying to play it up as a teenage thing as well, where the emotions are fast and furious, and the relationships kind of keep pace with that, and everything is such a big deal, and it's like everything is magnified.
Yeah, intense. I think you put, you know, 6 or 7 teenagers in a room for 24 hours, they'll all have dated and broken up in that 24 hours. So, I mean, in that way, it seemed pretty believable, you know, like...
Or, at the very least, you know, developed, like, ooh, could I? Is this person...
Right. And, I mean, it's not too much of a spoiler to say that the initial impressions of who, you know, has crushes on who does blow up and reorganize itself over time.
Yeah. The pairings don't last, is what you're saying.
Right,
Much like teenagers.
Right. Art imitating life once again.
Although Molly has not hooked up with anyone.
Well,
Molly has no sexuality, really, still. I mean, it's still her role to be the child within the group.
Mm. Is that helpful, do we think, to have a child in the group? I mean, that was kind of, I thought about, what is her function? You know, like, what is she bringing? I mean, she has a power, yes, like, I see that.
Well, one of her, just, you know, as a writerly sense, is she sometimes brings the funny.
Yeah.
Yeah,
where
she's the comic relief song.
Like, things are really intense, and then suddenly she says something ridiculous, or, you know, just, and
well,
you realize, oh, here's this 11-year-old in the middle of all this.
Right, it's, she's the commentator, you know, where she's not having the exact same experience as everyone else there, so she can observe it and kind of play up stuff. But I also think... kind of what I mentioned earlier, I think that part of them having to grow up so fast is the sort of pseudo-parental role they take on with her.
Mm.
And, I mean, it's like in Buffy, you know, Buffy taking care of Dawn was an essential part of that growing up arc.
Yeah.
You know, she, I think that's part of why she suddenly had a little sister, is so that they could play up her trying to be a parent.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I never thought of it that Dawn was the bringing in the cute kid syndrome that, like, so many shows went through.
Yeah.
Where...
Well, and that was the immediate reaction. It was like, oh, no. Oh, my God. Seriously? Cousin Oliver? You know?
Right.
But I don't think
that was introduced. But I think they did subvert that, and that Dawn wasn't particularly cute. And, you know, was at times purposely annoying rather than inadvertently annoying. And I liked Dawn a lot more than a lot of people do. So, I thought, you I sympathize. She did not have it easy.
I agree.
Yeah.
As, you know, Molly doesn't have it easy either.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I was going to say, we could probably wrap up. I mean, have we all said everything we wanted to say?
Well, the one thing I was curious about was if anyone had any favorites. Like, is there a character you like the most or identified with the most?
Well, I think I had mentioned that I think that Chase ended up being one of my favorites.
Yeah, Chase,
but again,
at least not within the first 18 issues that we read, was not, but he became one of my favorites. But through the whole thing, Gert was my favorite. I loved Gert.
I have to say that I do. I think I favor her as well. But I like Alex's thinking. But you know what? To be honest, I don't. I'm thinking he's a mole. That's my guess.
Yeah, it's for when that mole thing came in. Like, it totally threw me for a loop because I kept I can't imagine any of them being.
Yeah, I remember
that was my experience too.
Thinking, well, if any of them, maybe Alex. But as a since he's the strategist, maybe he's playing both sides against the man or something.
Right.
But yeah, but there was really nobody I thought was actually the mole.
No, they kept it pretty even. Like, everyone would say one little thing that would kind of make you be like, well, maybe you could maybe be.
Well, and I remember at that point in the story, I just loved them all so much already.
Yeah.
Which,
he did such a good job making that you really care about them and care about their group dynamic. And
yeah, I think that of all the aspects of the story and of Runaways and these early issues, like, that was the thing that struck me the most, is how much I cared early on without really any reason. You know, like it's not a story that I feel like, oh, that's such a cool story or anything like that. Like, it was just like, they just did such a good job of characterization, I think.
Yep.
Yeah. Like, which is not an easy thing to do.
No.
So it makes you immediately care about these characters.
No. But they're very relatable. I think any kid could pick one of these characters and find something that they connect with, they've kind of got the whole range covered.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you easily start to sympathize with them.
Yeah. What was the goth girl's name?
Nico.
Yeah. That was who that was always my favorite.
I think I'm a Gertrude. I gotta say, I like her sass.
Yeah. Well, okay. So just in the interest of choosing someone other than Gert, I'd say Carolina.
Yeah.
I really liked her.
I think she grew
the most.
See,
I kind of didn't like her.
See, that's this is where I'm having a hard time putting myself back in those first issues.
Yeah.
Well, it was something that I totally, rereading the first 18 issues, I had totally forgotten that she basically decides on suicide at one point.
Oh, yeah.
Because they get infiltrated by a vampire, and he causes havoc, and he nearly kills them all, and calls the cops on them, and all sorts of things, and she ends up defeating him by just kill me, I'm miserable, kill me, so he bites her, and then he explodes because her blood is basically liquid sunshine, and everyone's like, that was brilliant, and she's like, I meant it, I wanted to die.
Wow, I did not remember that.
Yeah, I think
I had completely forgotten that, totally blocked it from my mind.
Yeah. She does the most growing, I think, as a character. Like, she starts out pretty one-dimensional, and by the end of book three, I felt totally different about her than I had when it first started. Because she's kind of seems like maybe one of the more privileged ones. She's got the coolest power, so, like, she gets to fly and everything. And she's the most sympathetic to her parents early on. I mean, she's kind of being drug along for the ride. She's not like, yeah, let's get them. She's a little more like, well, maybe they had a good reason for what they're doing. Right, right. Like, it's kind of hard for them. So,
you get the impression that her parents were actually nice to her, which wasn't necessarily the experience of all the kids.
But she also kind of feels the most lied to then, too, because, she's like, they've just been acting this whole time. Like, I can't.
One of the things we see is they find a book of their parents that kind of records everything important that happened to the Pride. And they're sort of, they see their own origin story, and that the parents, Chase's parents, just sort of accidentally get pregnant. And part of the deal with being the Pride, being these three couples, six people together, or sorry, 12 people together, is that the Pride takes these six couples and tell them, for the next 25 years, you are going to have, you know, everything you possibly want, all the money, all the power, everything you want. At the end of the 25 years, we, these giant, crazy god things, are going to destroy the planet, and only six of you are going to be going to live in paradise in the post-apocalyptic world. So you guys are going to have to choose which six of you it is. And then when Chase and his parents get pregnant, they all sort of decide, each one of us are going to have one child, so there will be six children, and those six children are going to be the ones who live forever in paradise. Once the giant monster things destroy the world. And we find out Carolina's parents never wanted kids. But since everybody else was doing it, they had to.
Wow. So, yeah, so they were the biggest yeah. liars.
So for supervillains, they were all very self-sacrificing. Well, would have been self-sacrificing.
Well, it's easy to say before it's...
Revelations where, like, at the end of it, they find that out. They think, well, that's at least a little bit noble. Our parents kind of do love us in their weird, demented way.
That group decides not to, right? So then then the double cross comes in, and they're like, well, actually, we don't really want to die. So, you know,
I think the mutants and the aliens decide it's just going to be us two parents and our kids, so the six of us are going to be the ones who...
Which gets into the whole supervillains double-crossing each other. Right. Yeah.
Well, and if you were this, like, all-powerful evil being, would you really tell your minions that they couldn't all live? Like, they were going to have to choose? Why wouldn't you just wait till the end?
Well, but it's, like, perfect capitalism, though. Like, get them to, like, turn on each other and be super competitive and get the best production out of everybody before you're going to off them, which we don't even know, like, at least in the first three books, like, we just know the wave is coming, or the next wave, or new wave, or whatever it is. So, it sounds ominous. I don't know exactly how it works, but I don't want to be wrong for whatever wave is coming.
Well... Should
and
we
don't necessarily know that the giants were going to save the six.
Right.
That's true.
You can't trust them either.
Yeah. That's just what they said.
You never can trust those...
Those giants.
Giant
what were they called? They were
things.
The Gibberum?
Gibberum.
Gibberum? Yeah.
Is that a real thing? Or, well, not like a real thing, but, you know.
It sounds vaguely biblical.
Made up or something
it's
that
Hebrew.
Took from something else.
It does sound Hebrew.
Yeah.
But is it Hebrew, or...
Well, should we leave that as a mystery for the listener to solve?
Yeah, hey, if anyone's listening, go ahead and post and tell us the answer.
And with that...
We're too lazy to look it up.
Goodbye!
I think we're going to say goodnight, and thank you all for listening to our conversation about Runaways by Brian K. Vaughan.
Thank you, Susie. Thank you for the good input.
And we'll be letting everyone know what our next pick is going to be sometime.
Yes.
Yeah, probably soon, hopefully.
Someone who's probably better organized than I am about getting the next one together. Okay, good night.
Good night.
Bye.